Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, 50 people have been arrested in connection to the largest college admission scam in American history. Plus, starting the summer, riding the T will be more expensive, but not everybody agrees with the decision.
I don't think we needed another fare hike. There are better solutions and better ways to manage the MBTA funding.
Also today, a local Methodist leader says the church is sending the wrong message to the LGBTQ community.
You may love God or your partner, but not both at the same time. It is theologically tempting to shore up by keeping out, but it has no future.
And is there a formula for raising successful kids?
Independent of a parent's education or income or race or ethnicity, these same eight roles were almost always there.
It's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. A nationwide college admissions cheating and recruitment scheme has led to the arrest of 50 people across the country. At a press conference earlier today, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling described the alleged scheme as the largest college admission scam in history.
These parents are a catalog of wealth and privilege. Based on the charges unsealed today, all of them knowingly conspired to help their children either cheat on the SAT or ACT and or buy their children's admission to elite schools through fraud.
And joining me now with the latest on this developing story is WBUR reporter Fred Tice. Fred, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, great to do it.
So what can you tell us about this scheme? What are we actually talking about here?
So, Chris, let me give you a little flavor of what prosecutors say that the person at the center of this scheme, a college consultant named Rick Singer, would tell his clients. They say they have a recording of him where he's talking to a parent, and he says, "What we do is we help the wealthiest families in the U.S. get their kids into school. My family's want a guarantee." And the way this would work would be, there are several ways this would work, right? One, he would designate somebody to take the test for your kid or to correct your kid's scores, allegedly, right? There's a conversation, there are conversations allegedly between this man and parents and his clients where he says to them that, you know, they can decide what score they want their kid to have on the SAT or the ACT, and the college, this top college test taker that he had working for him allegedly, would then get more or less that score for the kid. But there's another way that they would get their kids into college. Allegedly, everything is allegedly here, and that is he would bribe coaches at nine universities, as far as we know so far. By doing things like – so these coaches had spots, right, for getting a certain number of kids on their team, and the admissions department had given them a certain number of slots. And so he would bring these kids in for that particular sport, even though they might not even play that sport. And the scam was that you would take pictures of these kids playing these sports that they don't play, or even Photoshop their faces onto the faces of other scholar athletes,
wow.
other high school athletes, parents could write off these bribes also as on their taxes because they're either paying them, to the college
consulting service,
he set up this foundation where you would donate the money to the foundation, and it was to help underprivileged kids.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned William Rick Singer, who's allegedly at the center of all this. What more can you tell us about him and his involvement?
So he's based in California. He was the owner of Edge College and Career Network, and he was chief executive officer of this charity that he'd set up called Key Worldwide Foundation. And he was paid around $25 million total. This is over the course of 7 years.
Okay, so I mentioned at the top we're talking about 50 people who have been arrested. You've got parents, coaches, SAT exam proctors, administrators who all allegedly took part in these schemes. What do we know about the people who have been arrested, and did anybody stand out?
So they were charged with conspiracy to commit mail fraud or racketeering. The parents maybe are the most interesting. They include celebrities like Felicity Huffman. These parents allegedly paid anywhere between $100,000 and $6.5 million for the service. Wow. Here's Andrew Lelling.
This case is about the widening corruption of elite college admissions through the steady application of wealth combined with fraud. There can be no separate college admissions system for the wealthy, and I'll add that there will not be a separate criminal justice system either.
So that's obviously Lelling talking about the seriousness of this infraction, but we also have a cut of him talking about the parents.
The parents charged today, despite already being able to give their children every legitimate advantage in the college admissions game, instead chose to corrupt and illegally manipulate the system for their benefit. We're not talking about donating a building so that a school's more likely to take your son or daughter. We're talking about deception and fraud.
And Lelling says that this is the largest college admissions scam in the history of the Justice Department.
So we're talking about pretty elite schools here. We're talking about, as you said, Yale, Georgetown, Stanford, UCLA, USC, Wake Forest. Is there any indication that any of these schools knew what was going on?
There's no indication that any of the colleges knew. So far, nine schools are known to be allegedly targeted, and Lelling says prosecutors could discover more. But at this point, he says they're not suspecting the colleges of being actively involved in this kind of fraud.
Okay, final question, kind of a two-part question. What's next for these kids who have now allegedly bought their way into these schools, and what's next for this investigation?
So for the kids, Lelling says they're not going to go after the kids. As far as he knows, the colleges are not implicated. This case is being led here in Boston. It started out with an investigation into fraud at Northeastern, at Boston College, and at Boston University. And he says, obviously, we are going to follow this case very closely.
As will we here at WBUR. That's WBUR reporter Fred Tice. Fred, thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
All right, heads up, fellow T-Riders. Starting July 1st, it's going to be more expensive to ride the T and the commuter rail. Yesterday, the MBTA's Fiscal and Management Control Board voted unanimously to increase fare prices by just over 6%. There was one abstention. The decision faced intense opposition from dozens of transportation experts and advocates, but some say it could actually provide a revenue boost that the T desperately needs. And joining us now to talk about this is former state Transportation Secretary Jim Aloisi. He's also a member of the Transit Matters Board and the principal of Trimount Consulting. Jim, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And also here with us is Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and the head of Chippio Strategies. Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this as well. How do you feel about the T fare hike? Will you stop riding the T now that it's going to be more expensive? Do you think this will actually improve service for the MBTA? You can give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet at us at Radio Boston. So let me start with both of you guys. Just give your general reaction to this fare increase. Is this a justified raise?
Well, no, I have opposed the fare hike, and I don't think it's justified by the numbers. And I think what happened yesterday really underscores what's really happening here. And so you've got a few people who think, well, the legislature allows us to have these incremental increases on a regular basis, so we should always do that as a way to sort of predictably raise MBTA fares. But what you saw yesterday were many members of the Fiscal Management and Control Board publicly expressing what many of us in the advocacy community have known and have been talking about for a while, which is basically that board has used all the tools in the toolbox in terms of its ability to generate net new revenue. The capital needs, the capital investment needs of the system are so large that the only way to solve it is not through a fare hike. It's through legislative and gubernatorial action at a scale that the T on its own initiative can't possibly undertake. And so while I'm glad that the fare hike kept bus riders harmless and kept a variety of riders harmless, that was a wise decision, I think what was really telegraphed there was the need to move this discussion to Beacon Hill, where we need significant action in the first 6 months of this year if we're going to get out of the hole that we're in.
So we'll get into some of those big picture solutions that you might be talking about. But Charlie, your initial reaction seeing this fare increase?
Well, my initial reaction was sort of a lukewarm okay on it. I mean, I was very glad to see that the bus routes were exempted and the fares for the elderly and the kind of last minute changes that were made. I do think we're in a situation right now where you know, the money is probably needed, but I think we really need to get about doing the business to make this to make this less to make these needed far less often in the future, and also, you know, we can't put all of the weight on the riders of the T. You know, we really need to start looking at the tolling and congestion pricing kind of issues that that could also raise.
Yeah, I think that's been the natural reaction for some of the advocates saying, hey, folks who are falling low income might have a hard time meeting these fare increases. How do you respond to those concerns?
Well, look, I mean, I think you're seeing in places like Seattle and some other places where now the technology exists to be able to reduce fares for low-income people. And I think that, you know, the T has been dramatically behind on technology, to say the least, over the years. And I think that, you know, we really need to start looking at that kind of technology to make the T more accessible to more people.
All right. I want to go right to the phones here. We've got Eric in Worcester wants to weigh in. Eric, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so I appreciate you taking my call. Thank you so much, and thank you all for talking about such an important topic. I think that this is really going to create an undue burden for a lot of riders. I commute in, like you mentioned, from Worcester, and for us, our monthly passes are going to go up by $25 a month. That's $300 a year, and for a lot of people, they aren't going to be able to afford that cost, and I think it's really unfortunate that for Worcester, we were the only meeting outside of Zone 4, and that meeting was only added on after the Central Mass Caucus weighed in asking for a meeting. So I think that often we're considered sort of an afterthought of the MBTA, despite the fact that we provide a substantial amount of commuter rail riders.
Some great points, Eric. What do you guys think? Was there enough thought put into kind of the expanse of where the commuter rail serves?
Well, the danger we have, and the caller is right, what the caller is pointing out is that fare hikes like this, what they do is they will push riders onto vehicles, right? We can hold lower-income people harmless if we try to do that. That's great. But if we push other riders, what I call riders who choose to take the T, onto Uber or Lyft or back into their car, we're adding to our chronic traffic congestion, and we're taking a completely wrong turn, no pun intended, when it comes to looking, advancing a sustainable mobility future. And so that caller raises a point. I understand there are many places within Boston where the monthly charge to park a car is less now than the commuter rail pass for the month. That's not credible as a way for us to think that we're going to manage a mobility system in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And to that point, the MBTA themselves have predicted this is going to lead to a 1.3% decrease in riders. We spoke with Chris Dempsey, the director of transportation for MA, Transportation Advocacy Group, earlier, and he said basically those riders are just going to head to their cars.
1% of ridership is 10,000 cars that are now back on our roads. Do we want those cars on the Pike or 93 or Route 2? Because that's where those trips are going to show up.
So this is an issue that obviously resonates with a lot of people in Boston. We talked recently about the congestion survey that said we had some of the worst congestion in the country. Is this, Charlie, going to just put more cars on the road?
It is. And I mean, I think that's why I think it's important that we also pursue these tolling and congestion pricing kind of solutions to this. And it can't all be on the back of the T, because clearly we want people to ride the T. We don't want to push people off the T.
So I think there's an interesting question there. You mentioned, Jim, Uber and Lyft and kind of these ride-sharing services that have become a large part of transportation in Boston. Is there a way, how should we be approaching dealing with those? I know Mayor Walsh has supported an increase in the 20-cent fee on those rides, but is there a realistic way that we can raise revenue?
Oh, sure, those? And I'm actually calling on the legislature in the first 6 months of this year to take three steps. Step one, raise the fees on Uber and Lyft on transportation network companies significantly, you know, not by another 20 cents, but by a couple of bucks, and dedicate that money to public transportation. Number two, have a carbon tax on non-residential parking in communities within the inner core of the Metro Boston region. Number three, enact into law Senator Lesser's Regional Ballot Initiative proposal, which is co-sponsored by 32 other legislators, including the chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee. That would allow cities and towns to, like they do in L.A. and Denver and St. Louis and many other places, to put on the ballot proposals to increase local fees for local transportation and mobility projects. You combine those initiatives together, and the speaker today said he wants the business community engaged. Fine. Let's put out some tax incentives for the business community to do things like get their employees for free to MBTA commuter rail, right? Let's let the business community roll out the region's largest electric vehicle charging platform. We could do a lot of things. There's no one silver bullet, but all of those things that I'm talking about combined could make a real difference, and that's what we need to be thinking about.
What do you think, Charlie? Would you support those types
of... Yeah, I mean, I would support some of them. I'm concerned about the about going too hard on the TNCs. I mean, there is a certain degree here to which clearly it is what people want. And, you know, I think that we can certainly create incentives for them to ride the T. But the reality is that if some of these TNCs are going to, are able to provide inexpensive rides that go point to point, you know, I don't think we can say that's not good and you have to ride the T. I mean, I think we need to improve the T. And yes, I don't have a problem with some increase on the fee, but I don't think we need to jack that fee up to essentially say to people, well, this is what you want to do, but we're not going to let you do it.
Do you have faith that this money is actually going to improve the T and improve service for riders?
Well, no. I mean, look, I have...
That's not heartening.
Well, no. I mean, look, I mean, this is where Jim and I disagree. I mean... I feel like there's no amount of money that you can put into the T right now that will really improve anything. I think they have made, for the first time, some serious progress in the last, you know, since 2015. But I think that for the money to matter at the T and really make a difference in people's lives, I don't expect the T to be a hyper, efficient organization, but we do need the T to get to the point of being a run-of-the-mill, inefficient government agency. And it's very, very far from that right now.
All right, we're going to get right back to the phones, but Jim, I'm just curious, as a former member of an inefficient government agency, what's your response to that?
Well, I think the T, look, I think the T does a better job than we give it credit for. The problem is not the people who work at the T. Problem is they don't have the resources. That was made very clear at the meeting yesterday. And so, look, we're going to need $11, maybe $15 billion to do what we need to do. But we're going to need $3 or $4 billion to electrify the regional rail system and give people frequent all-day service. We're going to need that money to connect the red and the blue line. We're going to need that money to provide – I took T rides today where my first stop was Broadway Station. It was flooded. The escalator wasn't working. My third stop was Logan Station. The ceiling's peeling and the escalators are out. We need to accelerate state of good repair. We need to give people frequent all-day service on regional rail. We need to connect the red and the blue line and do the kinds of things that will attract riders.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. Listeners, you can jump in 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Vic in Lexington actually supports the fares. Vic, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just thought I'd say, I know you're talking about how that you think the T may not be getting, the money that's going towards the T may not be improving the actual buses. I can only speak for the buses, but whenever I do commute, I've noticed recently that they've started adding cameras, become a lot more high-tech, and like you were talking about with Uber and how we need to get this a lot more modern, the fact, I personally think that this increase in money is actually worth it, because you can see the buses with all the new tech, they make them seem a lot more safer, a lot more desirable, and I noticed a lot more people getting on the buses. So
yeah, Vic, it's an interesting point, and I want to add to that. We obviously reached out to the MBTA and the Department of Transportation, and they sent us a statement. Before the 2016 fare increase, money from fare hikes went only to cover uncontrolled increases in expenses, not to improve service. Now, because of progress to transform the MBTA, additional revenue from riders as well as from taxpayers can be invested in both assets and service improvements. Is that a valid point, Jim? Do you think that improving the service is worth maybe asking riders to chip in a little more?
I'm all for people paying an appropriate fare for improved service. And so, yeah, I see the link. But what I'm saying and what you heard yesterday from the T board is that the scale and the dimension of the capital investment needs go well beyond what could ever be addressed by periodic fare increases. And so what we need to do is just look at ourselves in the Massachusetts mirror and realize that we're not going to solve the problem on the backs of TIF riders with fare hikes, and that we need to turn to the people who can make a difference, the folks in the legislature and the governor, to raise the kind of significant, stable net new revenue that gets us the kinds of improvements that I talked about earlier.
But I think we also have to look at the fact that for several years, up until very recently, the T annually had hundreds of million dollars sitting in saving accounts for money that was budgeted for the cap to do these capital projects, but they couldn't get out the door. Now they're finally starting to get better at that. But and that's just one microcosm of the massive problems that they have there. I have no problem with spending more money on the T if it's going to get us better service. I'm not convinced that we're at a point where it is.
So there's also an issue of cost control, right? Because if you look at some of the overtime costs, for example, in 2018, overcosts for the MBTA were at about $81.9 million. That's a 13% increase from 2017, a 30% increase from 2016, and it was more than that crazy winter we had in 2015. So is the T doing enough to control its costs?
Do you know why you pay overtime? You pay overtime because you have work to do and not enough workers to do it. And so you have to get at other people, the people who you have, to work overtime. Nobody does overtime for the fun of doing overtime. They do it because they don't have the resources.
I think that's a nice thing to say in theory.
No, it's an accurate thing to say.
But I think the most cursory look at the T's overtime, where you have years and years and years of people signing off on their own overtime, zero record of what they did. People who made $300,000 a year because they were supposedly working 90 hours a week and then having another job. I think the idea that all this overtime is happening because there's so much more work to do. I don't think there's a lot to back that up, and that would be an understatement. And I would also say that overtime is the least of the problems when you're looking at the pension and the ride and the other issues that the T has to deal with in order to make this a system that could actually absorb the money and turn it into better service.
The T is a complex system. It's an old system. Is it perfect and hasn't been perfect? No. I think this governor and this secretary have done a good job correcting some of the sins of the past. I don't think I hope he's not saying that he thinks under the Baker-Pollock administration that there's profligate spending on overtime, right? I think they have. Therefore, they're spending it on overtime because they need to do it because they don't have the resources, number one. Number two, yes, the T has to provide services like the ride by federal law, and it's a moral obligation. So there are things that cost money. But all of these things pale in comparison to the need to invest in the system and a capital side to do things like give that fellow from Worcester 15-minute service all day long, to give someone who's trying to connect from Kendall Square to Logan a connection between the blue and the red line. So we can't keep kidding ourselves that we can reform our way out of a problem that we've been neglecting for decades.
Jim, do you honestly think that taxpayers should pay for 15-minute service at 2 o'clock in the afternoon from Worcester?
Absolutely, and I'll tell you why. Because okay. if I'm living in Worcester and I work in Boston, and I have a kid call at 2:30 that says my kid's sick and I need to get home, I want that train to be there every 15 minutes. Because if I don't, you're forcing me to drive.
But I think the point that Charlie is making is that a lot of the people that would be paying for that would not be using
right.
that service,
and
which
they would,
I understand
would not be
is
happy about paying for
to
that,
some element is true for a lot of the things
this
we pay for.
This is true in a democracy.
Right, right.
70-year-olds are not paying for education in school. They don't have children. I mean, you know, we've got to get out of this is mine and this is yours attitude. We're supposed to be a commonwealth. Having frequent all-day service at 2 p.m. is something that helps keep people off the road at peak. This is something that's of common interest to all of us.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. Nora in Dedham is on the line. Nora, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. What's on my mind is what about considering a comprehensive hike? In other words, just like there's a fare for students, what if there's a study as, I mean, people say, well, this is my income and this is how much of a hike I can afford. Because it's not the same for, I mean, obviously it's different for everybody. And for those who are really in a low income, they would be able to contribute perhaps a little bit, which is good. But then they can get a better, everybody can get a better service. That's my point.
Yeah. So, Nora, yeah, basically saying we should scale fares to the riders' ability to pay. How do you guys respond to that?
Well, we kind of did that yesterday. I mean, they you know, a lot, the youth pass, the senior pass, they were all held harmless. Bus service was held harmless. So, again,
I mean, there are low income riders that ride the T.
Yes, of course. But look, again, we can bring some measure of equity to fares. It's not a solution to the problem. And if you keep raising the fares on people who can afford to pay, all you're going to do is push them onto Lyft or Uber. And that, when you lose that rider who's choosing to be on the T, and you have the T basically left with only people who are using it out of necessity, you've lost its egalitarian ethos. It's a disaster waiting to happen.
All right, I want to ask about one more possible solution, and that is the always controversial gas tax. Speaker DeLeo, you mentioned earlier today, kind of referenced this while talking at a Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce breakfast, that anything and everything is on the table, including raising the gas tax. I'm thinking back to 2014, and that spirited campaign, basically. Do you guys think that's a realistic solution that might have a chance in the legislature, and would it address some of the issues we're talking about?
I think the more realistic solution is to do what I had said earlier, enact Senator Lesser's regional ballot initiative law, enact Senator Boncori and Representative Madaro's TNC fare hike law. They're already filed. They're there. Enact them before July. If the speaker wants to have a conversation about the gas tax, I'll be first in line to have that conversation. I tried raising it by 19 cents 10 years ago, and I've lived to tell the tale. Not the easiest thing to do. But sure, everything should be on the table. But what I'm saying is he's got some bills in front of him today. They should enact them into law with all due haste.
Well, I was on Jim's side in the last one when it came to the indexing it, and I lost on that.
Thanks.
I think the gas. I think the gas tax is okay. I think that congestion pricing and tolling are better because they provide better demand management.
I'm really glad you raised congestion pricing, because one of the questions that I keep running through my mind is if you enact something along those lines, folks who are kind of stuck in that 9-to-5 job, aren't you kind of punishing them for basically not having the flexibility of someone who might in a higher paying job have to stay home or to alternate their schedules or kind of work around the congestion?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of it. I think it makes sense. I think it's a cost effective way to spread out demand and to get some cars off the road in the places where it's most congested.
I'm all for congestion pricing, but we're kidding ourselves if we think that we can politically do this without figuring out how to also toll I-93, I-91, I-495.
Absolutely.
You can't have a congestion pricing scheme that regionally is inequitable, where the only people paying are the people on the turnpike and using the Boston Harbor tunnels and bridge, right? So if we can cross the barrier and have a toll system that works regionally equitably, let's do it tomorrow.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. I have a feeling we'll be coming back to transportation issues at some point in the near future here on Radio Boston. That's former State Transportation Secretary Jim Aloisi. He's also a member of the Transit Matters Board and the principal of Tri-Mount Consulting. And Charlie Chippio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Thanks to both you guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. The United Methodist General Conference met in St. Louis at the end of last month, and in a heated and controversial vote, officially strengthened its ban on same-sex marriages and LGBTQ clergy. Methodists are the country's second largest Protestant church, and they have a long history here in New England. But the conference's vote runs contrary to most Methodist churches in New England, which welcome LGBTQ parishioners and clergy. So what impact will this vote have on the local branches of the Methodist Church, and what message does it send to parishioners and clergy? Joining us now in studio is Reverend Robert Hill. He's dean of the Marsh Chapel at Boston University, a professor of theology at BU, and an elder in the United Methodist Church. Dean Hill, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
So you've been an outspoken supporter of LGBTQ rights for many years. I'm curious, kind of, what's your message coming out of that vote?
Well, I want to start with the positive and just repeat what is the gospel itself, which is that God loves gay people, God's grace embraces gay people. The Bible says in Christ there is no male or female, and that's the message we try to convey at Marsh Chapel Sunday by Sunday, and continue to embrace the LGBTQIA community there. That said, what happened in St. Louis was an institutional failure and a spiritual defeat. And now we move forward and see what we can do in the future.
So speaking of moving forward, I mean, how does this vote actually affect kind of the day-to-day ministry in churches, especially here in New England?
Well, some of that will play out into the future. In one sense, what was done in St. Louis was that nothing was done. In other words, there was no change to make the church more open in terms of marriage and ordination. So there was I guess I would call it a negative continuity. But you know, Chris, the vote would have shifted with the change of 27 ballots. So it was a narrow vote, and two-thirds of the U.S. United Methodist delegates voted on the side of opening the church and affirming the presence of gay people. We just have a mixture of delegates and votes from overseas and a certain smaller fundamentalist cohort in the United States.
So I want to play a clip of one of the speakers at that conference in St. Louis. There was a promotional video that the church put out on the website, kind of highlighting some key moments. And I was just really struck by one of the speakers who said this.
We have brought people to Jesus because they said they have not heard this message before. They didn't know God could love them because their churches said God didn't.
So that really struck me to hear that and to hear that kind of passion. And I'm just curious what's going through your mind as you hear that and think about the fact that as speakers like that were presenting the case, it's still the vote went the other way.
Well, first, we didn't talk about this earlier, so I'm happy to identify that the speaker, J.J. Murray, is, as Jan and I are, from the snows of upstate New York. And he is one of the emerging bright leaders in our denomination. It happens, I learned this week, that he'll be coming to Boston University to study in the School of Theology. So I may have him in the Gospel of John class. I'm looking forward to that. But that 2 or 3 minute bit of rhetoric, which was wonderful, is a restatement of what we said at the outset. What that will mean into the future is that we really, Chris, have a split church right now. We have a good number of majority within the United States who are committed to ministry in, with, and for gay people, including marriage and ordination. And then we have the division mentioned earlier. The other side of it is that there is a judicial review of what was done in St. Louis this next month. So this April is one checkpoint. And then a year plus from now, there's another general conference in Minneapolis in April, May of 2020. So we'll have a chance to revisit this issue at that point. And those who voted in St. Louis in February were elected in 2015. So this is 2019. And you know what? Things change as the leadership in the church gets a little bit younger. The generations have a somewhat different view, and that has some harbingers of hope in it, too.
I'm just really curious. I mean, this must be a challenging moment for a lot of parishioners who belong to this organization that they feel is all about doing the right thing, and yet at the same time they see the official policy of that organization doing something they feel is the wrong thing. Are you hearing from parishioners asking you about this or talking about it?
Yes. Jan and I spent Friday, Saturday in our home neck of the woods, Rochester, New York, at a big meeting there of moderate liberal leaders, lay and clergy. And if I could mention one thing that people who are looking for something to do could do in New England, and I think your word, Chris, at the outset was accurate, that while there's a range and diversity of viewpoint, particularly in New England, this is a bridge that was crossed a long time ago, right. In some ways a very long time ago. So the majority viewpoint here is very much open and moderate and liberal. But it will help if the delegates who are elected this spring to go to the meeting next spring in the United States are as close to 90% at the liberal point as possible, and then we have a real shot at moving a further step forward. I'm hoping for that.
I'll admit I have no idea how that works. What's the process like for that?
One person, one vote. I mean, it's a, there's a, but just a, each church sends each a clergy church, okay, and lay member to annual conference, and yeah, then at annual conference there's a vote, and it's a very democratic system with all the pluses and other of that.
So how do you balance the views that you're talking about with, you know, there may be members of your church that agree with the vote, and how do you minister to kind of both sides of that issue?
Well, you know what? We have the real freedom and joy at Marsh Chapel, which is not under the aegis of the Methodist Church, although it has an historic Methodist root. We employ and deploy gay clergy on a regular basis. We marry gay people on a regular basis, and we have a very full, welcoming community there. We're grateful to WBUR for your sharing of our service over many decades into the past and into the future. We trust at 11 o'clock, and we hope others will listen. But, you know, that's a wonderful thing. It does, though, not come without some real hurt. This is a very hurtful thing that was decided or done in St. Louis, and we're trying to minister, particularly, if I may say, to those who are emerging in life and leadership within Methodism and beyond. So,
I want to play another piece of tape. This is from Reverend Tom Lambrecht. He's the Vice President and General Manager of the Methodist magazine Good News. He was talking on Point and basically said that this is kind of a fundamental issue at the core of the religion itself.
The question is, same-sex relationships, are they consistent with God's plan for human flourishing? And the Bible seems to say no, that we're better off if we engage in heterosexual relationships, or for many people, both heterosexual and homosexual, celibacy is also an option that the church supports.
So how do you respond to that?
Personally and biblically. Did you notice how he said seems to? That kind of caught my ear.
Yeah.
I'm a New Testament scholar. The New Testament has passages that condone slavery. The New Testament has passages that say women cannot speak in church. The New Testament has more than one list of the 12 disciples. The New Testament has a lot in it, including a few statements about homosexuality that do not comport with the height and breadth of the New Testament, which is found in Galatians 3:28. So I would start with somebody like Mr. Lambrecht with the Bible and say, no, what's in the Bible? Here's what's in the Bible. God is loving us into love and freeing us into freedom. And that's found in Galatians 3:28. In Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free. There is no male and female. It's a step toward a new creation. And I'm afraid his little catch there of seems to indicates more than he might have intended, that he hasn't quite gotten to the depth or height of the Scripture, in my opinion.
You kind of hinted at this earlier, but the church, I think nearly a third of the church's memberships is in Africa. Mm-hmm. Some of the most vocal proponents of this traditional plan that passed, mm-hmm, were speakers from places like Liberia and, mm-hmm, Russia. Mm-hmm. How does the global nature play into this, and how do you kind of grapple with that?
Well, that's one of the challenges, and it's a great gift of our mission and ministry, and we want to honor that. The churches I served heavily supported Africa University, for instance, and there are other examples, and we want to affirm that. That said, the support from the United States to these global ministries is massive. The global mission and ministry budget of the United Methodist Church is $400 million a year. $398 million of those are raised in the United States. So when two-thirds of the votes in the United States are in one direction, the support, financial support, is going one direction. That's something we're going to need to think about at the local level.
So are you hopeful for the future?
Well, I am hopeful because the opposite of hope is despair, and I'm hopeful. Optimism, that's qualified. It will depend on just how fervently lay and clergy leadership into the next several months are engaged in this.
All right, that's Reverend Robert Hill. He's the dean of the Marsh Chapel at Boston University, a professor of theology at BU, and an elder in the United Methodist Church. You can hear him during the Marsh Chapel service, as you implied there, here on WBUR, Sundays at 11 a.m.
Thank you.
Dean Hill, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Siderk. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. Anyone who's also a parent has felt that existential pressure. Am I doing everything I can to help my child be successful? It's such a big question, but my next guests say it could be as simple as following the formula. Ronald Ferguson is a Harvard professor and the director of the Achievement Gap Initiative at the university, and Tasha Robertson is a journalist and former reporter for the Boston Globe. The two of them teamed up to interview about 200 adults and their parents to come up with a blueprint for how to raise successful kids. They detail the results in their new book, The Formula, Unlocking the Secrets to Raising Highly Successful Children. Ronald Ferguson joins me now in studio. Ronald, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
And Tasha Robertson joins us from New York City. Hello, Tasha.
Hi there.
So, Ron, I'll throw the first question your way since you're here in the studio. Let's start with something basic. How do we define success?
Well, the way we define success is not by anyone's point of view other than the person whose success we're defining. We have a little equation in the book that says purpose plus smarts plus agency equals fully realized. So we're talking about fully realized human beings that make the most of their God-given resources.
So that's a pretty nebulous kind of concept, obviously. How do you measure that?
Well, the way we chose successful people,
right,
just
right,
to go
right.
That way. Is that we chose people who really stood out to us. About half the people in the book are Harvard graduates, and other people are folks we just ran into out in the world who impressed us. But I just want to say, though, that the definition of success is not that you have to be one of these super talented people like the ones we talk about in the book. The formula is more general than that.
All right. Tasha, can you talk a little bit more about how you guys chose which stories to focus on, why you decided to focus on this quote-unquote best of the best?
Yes. So at the time, I was a reporter for the Boston Globe, and I started working there, and I noticed there was just so many smart people in that newsroom, and I started traveling all over the country as a roving reporter correspondent. And I noticed when I talked to these really smart people, I would talk about how they grew up. And I noticed that they would talk about their parents in a similar way. And Ron, of course, was the achievement guru at Harvard. I used to interview him for years. And so for maybe 10 years on my own, I started interviewing people about, you know, people I thought were smart, people who were like at the top of their game, young and old, and just started interviewing people about how they got that way. And Ron was doing the same thing at Harvard. So as far as like how we picked them, we just picked people who stood out, people who were at the top of the top, people who we thought had a chance to change. They had something about them. We knew they could make a change in the world. And I think we were right. Many of the people we talked to and interviewed, I mean, they're in their 20s and 30s and they're already changing the world. They're doing amazing things. But we wanted to know, how did they get that way? And we believe parents had something to do with it. But we wondered, did race or did socioeconomics have something to do with it? And we found that wasn't the case.
All right. So that's something to unpack. We'll get into that. But I want to ask you first about, you talk about 8 different models, basically, or roles that the parent has to play.
Right.
The first being the early learning partner. I think that's something that, as I was reading, like that seemed, yeah, that makes sense. I have to pay attention to my kid as he's growing up in those first few years, help him develop this passion for reading and learning and things like that. I'm curious, as you were looking at these common traits, were there any that kind of surprised you that you maybe wouldn't have thought of just kind of instinctively?
The ones that stood out that really surprised me were the philosopher. Hadn't thought about that so much.
And tell us a little bit about what that
is. Okay, the philosopher is the parent who takes a child seriously as a thinker from the earliest days. A 3-year-old can ask a really deep question, and the philosopher parent is going to think hard about it, maybe go away for a day or two and come back with an answer. These people said their parents always talk to them as an adult. But the philosopher is the parent who helps the child to find meaning, find a sense of purpose, to establish an ethical compass. And all the people we focus on had a mission. they had something they were trying to do in life, and you could trace it often back to the conversations they'd had with this philosopher parent.
I have to say, reading that idea of treating your child as an equal was really reassuring for me, because that's an approach. I have a 3.5-year-old.
Yes.
And sometimes I find myself wondering, what am I doing negotiating with a 3.5-year-old? This is crazy.
That's right. Good.
But yeah, that really does kind of help.
But then you find the negotiator is one of our roles.
Yes, exactly. And it helps them develop this sense of kind of agency, right?
Yes,
can you talk
exactly.
a little bit about that?
Exactly. Yeah. The negotiator will negotiate with the child, but will also help the child to negotiate outside the household. Tachi, you want to take this one?
Well, I'll give you an example of a negotiator. There was a young lady named Maya. I think she ended up going to Harvard. But when she was in second grade, she had an issue with her teacher. And the teacher was just teaching the kids cartwheels, and Maya wanted to learn. So Maya, the teacher would say, Maya, won't you play? Why don't you hang out with us? And Maya said, I want to learn. I want to read. So she went to her mom, and she said, Mom, what am I to do? You know, what should I do? And she asked her mother, actually, what are you going to do about this? And the mother said to Maya, what are you going to do, Maya? Not what am I going to do? So she gave her a few things to say, and Maya, second grade Maya, walked to the principal's office, told the principal about what was happening, had it set up a meeting, and the principal actually took her seriously because Maya was self-advocating for, you know, she had a problem and she had to deal with it. So when the teacher actually went to the classroom, saw what was going on, noticed that the teacher was not so great, that she was very green, when Maya came back the next semester, the teacher was not there. And so it's just a story. This is just one of many stories of children taught at very young ages how to self-advocate, how to negotiate for themselves.
Such an important life skill. Tacha, I want to come back to something you said at the beginning of the interview, that you guys found that race and social class don't matter. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that's a pretty staggering claim, I think, for a lot of people.
It is. Well, I was a reporter, like I said, at the Boston Globe, and I was fascinated by this issue about how people got smart, and I thought it was maybe white middle-class parents knew something that everyone else did not know. And as I started interviewing people, and Ron, he had a whole other project that he was working on, we noticed that it really didn't matter. Because, for example, one young man, Jarrell Lee, brilliant. Jarrell Lee grew up partially in a homeless shelter. And his mother would sit down. She was a great early learning partner. And I don't think the early learning partner is fascinating. So young Jarrell and his mother would sit in a homeless shelter on a bed, and she would give him flashcards and teach him how to read and teach him math. And so we saw that across the board. Every parent we talked to taught their child, they didn't just read to their child, they taught them how to read.
So I guess my question is, are you making the contention that there are not extra obstacles that face people who, whether it's systemic racism or coming from a lower income
social
class?
We're making the contention that the formula is pretty much the same formula, independent of background. People from different backgrounds face different hurdles, but they don't let those hurdles knock them out of the saddle.
But we've seen a pretty demonstrable achievement gap, both in terms of race and in terms of income.
Right.
Is that an indictment of parenting?
No, the people we're looking at are at the top of the heap, no matter what the race or ethnicity is.
Right.
Right? So we're talking about the folks who end up being outstanding graduates from elite universities. Those folks were very often, and we found pretty universally in our book, have experienced these same eight experiences, the same eight roles in the formula that their parents played. And so what we're saying is, when we look at somebody who's had two parents who were both lawyers versus somebody who was homeless as a little kid, and we get into their story, they all had the early learning partner, the flight engineer, the fixer, the revealer, the philosopher, the model, and the negotiator.
So I'm curious because, we think of Harvard, obviously, as maybe the top school in the country.
Right.
But we actually spoke on Radio Boston with Anthony Jack. He's a Harvard professor whose research kind of focuses on poor students at rich college campuses like Harvard. And it's fascinating because he talked about how structural policies really kind of limit some of those kids. Here he is.
we think that just because students are getting in and getting in under these conditions, that they're going to be okay. And then we realize, like, how many of these, this hidden curriculum that students have to engage, these unset rules and unset and hidden expectations that trip students up. But they also have these official policies that they have to confront, like the closing of dining halls, that really does undercut their ability to be full functioning people.
So talking about kind of the institutional mm-hmm. support and how the discrepancy there, I mean, how do you respond to that?
The folks that Tony is looking at graduated from Harvard. They're out in the world now.
But face
because
challenges.
They face that, the point, yeah. The question is not whether they face challenges. The question is whether they push through those challenges. And what we're saying is that the folks, most of the ones that Tony's talking about too, they pushed through those challenges. They were hurt by it. They experienced all kinds of setbacks, but they had what it took because they did have philosophers and negotiators and models and revealers that helped them to get where they got to.
We'll have to end it there. That's Ronald Ferguson, Harvard professor and director of the Achievement Gap Initiative at the university. And also joining us from New York, Tatcha Robertson, journalist and former reporter for the Boston Globe. The new book is called The Formula, Unlocking the Secret to Raising Highly Successful Children. Thank you guys both for being here.
Thank you.
Okay. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.